Alice and Rebecca stirred while we packed and said a few perfunctory goodbyes, each of us distracted by the unknowns that lay ahead of us. Once we were all packed and had our gear on, we exited the room, quietly closing the door behind us. We had agreed in the room to maintain strict silence until we were clear of our little interstate community. It was also agreed that I would take the lead until we were clear of town. I removed my headlamp and showed Gary how to carry it with the lens pointing into your hand, just opening your fingers enough to allow sufficient light to escape to where you directed it to. By this method, you could conceal most of the brightness of your light, but still see where you needed to go. Randy followed suit, and we headed single file down the hallway and into the stairway, shutting the stairwell door as quietly as possible and starting down the stairs. When we exited the stairwell near the lobby, I noticed that the lobby was full of people sleeping on the furniture and stretched out on the floor. This was clearly one of the bottom-tier rooming plans that the desk clerk had mentioned to us. Despite the unpleasantness of our dark room and the stinking hallway, I was sure it was much quieter and safer than this lobby. I didn't want to walk through that group of people and take a chance on waking someone. I held out my hand to stop Gary and Randy, then motioned for them to follow. I changed direction and headed down the first-floor hallway and away from the lobby. At the end of the hall, we exited to the parking lot, pushing the panic bar on the glass and aluminum door as gently as possible to avoid making unnecessary noise. Once free of the building, I breathed a sigh of relief. The air was cool, the early morning quiet. The sky had started to lighten at the horizon. We needed to be gone before full light. When I went on backpacking trips, I always awoke to a sensation similar to this, a mixture of relaxation, mild adrenaline, and anticipation. This time, however, it was not about the journey, as those backpacking trips were. This was all about the destination. I was anxious to get this show on the road and get home to my family. It was amazing what we'd been through in just 24 hours. It felt like a week ago that those terrorist attacks had occurred. I hadn't received a text back from my family, and now my phone was probably dead. I would charge it later with the solar charger from my pack and try again. We were on the northwest side of the interstate. I pointed toward the highway to the south and started walking through the parking lot to the back of the hotel. I could tell that Gary and Randy had expected me to use the access road leading to the hotel, but it was clear to me that there were still too many people in their vehicles. I didn't want to rouse any suspicion or have anyone see where we were going. I didn't want to be questioned or followed. Maybe I was just paranoid, but I preferred to think of it as operational security. I also remembered the old saying that you're not paranoid if people really are out to get you. In my bug-out bag, I carried a Virginia Gazetteer, which is a large booklet containing topographic maps of the entire state. Since most of my work travel was within the boundaries of Virginia, I'd always believed that if the shit were to hit the fan when I was on the road, odds are it would be on a Virginia road. I also carried a highway map of the southeastern United States that was not as detailed but would point me in the right general direction to get me back to my own state. I even took the trouble of plotting return routes and carrying maps for family vacations with the kids. My goal was never to be caught unprepared and without a plan to get home. We've already established that I'm paranoid. I had a compass, too, but I also went one degree better. 2 years ago, I had bought a new GPS for my backpacking trips. It was a top-of-the-line Garmin with a color touchscreen. When I bought it, I retired my old Garmin eTrex to my bug-out bag. It was still a good functional unit, and I preloaded it with topo maps for the western half of the state, which is all the older unit's memory would hold. As long as the GPS satellites were still functioning, and I had no reason to think they weren't, this unit could be invaluable. I also had spare lithium batteries for it, which were both lighter than alkaline and longer-lasting. Passing through the back lots of the hotel and adjacent buildings, we made it to the interstate without meeting another person. At the edge of the right-of-way, we climbed a chain-link safety fence, crossed the four lanes of I-81, climbed another fence, and took stock of our surroundings. Since the businesses were all located on the north side of the highway, there were only a few stray cars here on this side. I could not see any people or any movement. We walked down the shoulder through tall grass and weeds at an angle that would eventually intersect the side road at a point past any parked vehicles. The dampness of the grass and weeds soaked our pants legs. My shoes remained dry since they were good quality Salomon hiking boots. I suspected that Gary was wearing hiking boots of a similar quality. I knew, however, that Randy's running shoes had to be getting soaked. When the sun heated up later, it would probably dry out our pants and Randy's shoes. Hopefully it would be before blisters consumed her feet. We stayed in the weeds until we were completely out of sight of the road, then we stepped down onto the pavement and began walking on the flat road surface. The road apparently did not lead into any town, and there had been no roadblock of any sort on this side of the interstate. There would be houses and maybe even businesses here, so we would have to remain alert to the possibility of encountering other people. There could also be other travelers, some potentially threatening. It felt strange to be telling myself that I had to consider anyone we encountered as a potential threat, but was that not the world we were in now? How could I make it home thinking any other way? Randy lit up a cigarette. "You need to quit those things," I said. She looked at me, thinking about her response. It was clear that she was similar to me and that she had a visible reaction to people telling her what to do. She thought before responding, though, seeing that I was not attacking her, but just being my normal, blunt self. "I'll have to in a day or so anyway," she said. "I've only got one more pack left. This first one of the day is important." I smiled to myself. "Wake and bake, huh?" She laughed. "That's weed, not cigarettes. And without coffee, I need to take what vices I can get." "Don't get me started on coffee," I said. "I miss it, too." "Well, now that we can talk," Gary said, "what's the plan? How the hell are we getting home?" "I've literally thought about this for years. I think safety and security has to be our first concern," I said. "It's too dangerous to just take the easy route down the interstate. I think we need to take a discreet route with minimal exposure to towns and people. Since we travel to Richmond so often, I established a get-home plan from there years back. It involved using the Appalachian Trail." Gary thought about it, nodding. "I can see the logic in it. It avoids population centers and nearly takes us all the way to Tazewell County. That's only 25 miles from home for me." "It's about 35 miles from my home," I said. "That's still relatively close." "Isn't that trail rough?" Randy asked, a little apprehension in her voice. "Up and down mountains, muddy, sleeping in the woods kind of stuff?" "Yes," I said. "I've hiked large sections of it, and it is challenging, but I think it's our safest route." "How far are we from the AT now?" Gary asked. "Around 6 miles." "That close? I had no idea." "Yes," I said. "It parallels the Blue Ridge Parkway not far from here. We can be there by lunchtime." "We can walk 6 miles in a day?" Randy asked doubtfully. "I never walked 6 miles in my life." 15's a good average day for me," I said. "I've hiked that and longer with a 45-pound pack many times. By the time we get home, you'll be able to do a 20-or-more-mile day if you want to, especially if you're not smoking cigarettes." Randy made a snorting sound like she didn't believe me. "You can do it, Randy. But if you're having second thoughts, we're still close enough to the hotel that you can go back. I'm not trying to run you off. I just want to make sure you know what you're getting into. The options are trust the government or bust your ass to get home. That's the long and short of it." She finished her smoke and flipped the butt to the pavement, stepping on it. "First off, I will bitch, moan, whine, and complain, but I will fucking well make it. Ain't nothing you guys can do that I can't, short of peeing standing up. Second, if I have to travel with those women, I will go off and hurt someone. No doubt about it, they are not my kind of people."
"I think we can all make it, too, but not on the food we've got," Gary said. "We'll have to resupply somewhere along the way. I've got some Cliff Bars and some dehydrated meals, but it's probably only 3 days' worth. And I guess there's whatever was in that bag you gave me last night, the origin of which I shall not ask about."
"I confess," I said. "I busted open the candy machines, and we probably have about 50 packs of candy bars, jerky, nuts, and crackers between us."
"You damn delinquent,"
Randy teased. What would Alice say? I know, I admitted. In my pack, I've got a Gatorade bottle of rice and one of beans. I've also got a Ziploc baggie with a couple of box macaroni dinners and a few dehydrated meals in it. Not enough to get us home. I'm sorry, guys, I got nothing, Randy said.
Don't worry about it, Randy, Gary said. Not everyone is as paranoid as we are.
In light of current circumstances, I would no longer refer to you as paranoid, but instead as just prepared, Randy said.
So we've got maybe a week's worth of meals, Gary said.
I've got a potential resupply point in mind, I said. My best friend from high school, Lloyd Earhart, lives about an hour's drive from here. Or a 4-day walk at 13 miles a day, Randy added sarcastically. Yeah, about that long, I said. He runs a barber shop in a small town just off the AT. He's also the mayor.
The mayor? Gary asked.
Yep, think about it. You got a small town of about 250 people. Who knows more people than the barber? He's been mayor there for nearly 20 years, usually running unopposed. He listens to people bitch all day long, so he's on top of the issues.
You think we can resupply there?
I'm pretty sure, I said. He kind of lives in the past anyway. I'm sure he's probably holed up in the old building he lives in, sipping moonshine and playing the banjo. He doesn't really care much for the modern electronic age. He probably has a friend with a store who will help us out. What's the name of the town where he lives? Randy asked.
Crawfish. What about water? Gary asked. How you set for water?
I have 6 bottles left from my original stash in my pack. I picked up another 6 from the food tent yesterday when we ate. That's actually way more water than I prefer to carry. I also have purification tablets and my Katadyn camper pump filter.
That's good, Gary said. I've got 4 big bottles of spring water and some purification tabs. With your filter, we should be in good shape all the way home.
What's a pump filter? Randy asked.
I use it for backpacking. It allows you to pump water out of lakes, streams, and springs and filter it clean enough to drink. I even used it several times on Roan Mountain in Tennessee to suck water out of puddles during a dry summer hike when a lot of the springs were dried up, I said.
You drank puddle water? Randy asked, turning up her nose.
Yes, I did, and I liked it.
How did it taste?
Like rotten leaves, I said.
In case you ever get the chance to drink water filtered from Whitetop Laurel Creek in Damascus, Virginia, that's the best creek I ever tasted. The leaf water was probably the worst.
All this talk of food and water's making me hungry, Gary said. I'm used to fueling up first thing in the morning. Any objection to stopping to divvy up some candy bars and water?
Not at all, I said. Let's do it.
We were sitting on the shoulder of the road, sucking down water and eating candy bars, when I heard the sound of some type of engine in the distance. I finished my 2nd Snickers bar and wiped my hands on my pants. I threw the wrapper on the ground. After I did, I stared at it for a minute and thought about how I'd always adhered to leave-no-trace ethics in the woods and made my kids carry out every piece of trash they made. I picked it back up and shoved it in my pocket. I could burn it later in a campfire. Randy shook her head.
Leave your trash if you want to, but I'm burning mine tonight, I said. I can't make myself do it when I have a choice. I've spent too many years cussing other people when I found their trash in otherwise pretty spots.
Gary laughed to himself.
What's with you? Randy asked him.
It's funny, but it's also not funny at all, Gary said.
What's that? I asked.
That you can kill a man and rob a vending machine, but you can't litter, he said, no longer laughing.
That is pretty funny, now that you put it that way, I said.
I guess a man has to draw the line somewhere.
The wrapper stays in my pocket. The engine noise was getting louder.
The road we were walking on was a rural 2-lane that passed through fields broken only by the occasional distant farmhouse. Some dogs had barked at us as we walked by, but none had come close. I was sure that people were watching from the houses, though no one came out. The engine noise approaching us had defined itself and was clearly a tractor.
"You hear that?" Gary asked. "Should we hide out?"
"Let's stay put here on the ground," I said. "We look less threatening sitting here eating."
It was only a moment before an old blue Ford tractor rattled into sight, a haymowing blade extending from the left side. The tractor carried the blade in a raised position that allowed it to travel down the road without taking out mailboxes. The man noticed us as soon as we saw him, detectable only by a slight swerve in his steering. Other than that swerve, nothing changed until he was directly alongside us. Then he braked, stared at us without expression for a moment, and killed the tractor engine. He continued to stare, saying nothing. He wore green pants and a matching green shirt like a mechanic's uniform, with a white T-shirt underneath. The pants were tucked into dirty rubber boots. The man looked to be in his 60s, but it was hard to tell with farmers. They weathered early. "Morning," I said, nodding in his direction. He nodded back, then spat tobacco juice onto the road. "You folks lost?" "Depends on what you mean by lost," I said. "We're a long way from home without a ride, but we do have a plan for getting home." He thought about this for a moment. "Guess you ain't lost, then," he said. "More like you're stuck." "That's about the size of it. We were on our way back home and got caught up in all this mess going on. We were stuck at the exit back there, and things were getting ugly. Today they're making everyone who stayed there go to a FEMA shelter, so we made a break for it." The man's eyes got wide. "FEMA? They're putting people in camps?" "Well, they call them shelters," Gary said. "But we didn't trust them, so we started walking." "Where's home?" the man asked. "Tazewell and Russell counties," I said. The man whistled. "That's a damn far piece." "That's a fact," I stated. "Ain't you going in the wrong direction?" he asked, calculating our route in his head. "You need to be going southwest. You're going south." "We're heading for the Appalachian Trail. It'll take us home without having to pass through a lot of towns." He considered this. "That ain't a bad idea," he said. "Hard walking, but safer than staying on the roads." "Have you heard any news lately?" Gary asked. "What's going on out there?" The man spat again, then wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. "The White House has gone silent, is what I'm hearing on the radio. We ain't got power, so I don't know if television news is working or not. They say the president is holed up in a bunker somewhere till they figure out if there's going to be more attacks. All the major cities are declaring martial law. They talked about doing martial law nationwide, but a reporter interviewed some retired general, and he said they don't have enough troops. Half what they do have ain't showing up for work. Gone AWOL to take care of their families, I guess." The man twisted around in his seat to face us better. "One of my neighbors has shortwave, and he says the word is that they destroyed most of the big oil refineries, and they'll take years to repair. They also destroyed so many power stations that there aren't enough transformers to fix them, and they can't make more because they don't have any power at the factories that make them. Now, ain't that a pickle?" He also said that Nashville was pretty much wiped off the face of the earth by floodwaters from a busted dam. We all shook our heads in disbelief. Much of this news matched the bits and pieces we'd heard yesterday, but it was still hard to digest. Despite our problems, and they were significant, at least we were still alive and healthy for the moment. "I'm thinking we're about 4 miles from the trail," I said. "Do you know if that's right or not? The map shows there's a parking lot near the end of this road that connects with the trail."
4 miles?
The man said, thinking.
"That'd be about right."
"Guess we should get going then," Gary said. "We got a long way to go."
"It's only about 1 mile if you cut across my farm," the farmer said.
"I noticed on the map that the trail was up on that ridge," I said. "But without an access trail, it looked like it'd mean climbing straight up a hillside through rhododendron thickets. They can be damn near impossible to get through without a trail."
"You remember that big forest fire last year?" the farmer asked.
I nodded. It had made the news statewide.
"Forest Service had to cut a fire road right through my property to get to it," he said. "It joins right up with that trail you're talking about."
"That's good news," I said. "You don't mind us crossing your property?" The man shook his head.
"You folks look like you could use a boost," he said. "We got enough hard times ahead of you already."
We all agreed to that.
"About 100 yards up the road's a gate on the right," he said. "Go through that gate and lock it back so the cows don't get out. Follow the gravel road that goes straight up into the woods. It'd lead you right to where you're going and save you about 8 miles of walking.
I walked over to the tractor and stuck out my hand.
We appreciate this, I said.
The man took my hand and shook.
No problem, he said. Y'all be careful, and remember to close the gate.
I promised him that we would, and picked up my pack. He started his tractor and pulled off down the road. Gary and Randy stood and gathered their gear. Randy stretched.
I'm all for saving miles.
Then let's get going, I said, heading down the road for the gate.
Chapter 13.
When Ellen awoke, she did not initially recall that she was in the middle of a crisis. The children were in the bed with her, which was not completely different than any other summer day, where Jim would get up early and go to work while she and the kids slept late. As a teacher, Ellen enjoyed having her summers off as much as the children did. Their days began slowly, and she loved that. She rose from the bed to go to the bathroom, then remembered that the power was out. It was a dark cloud descending on her, remembering that her husband wasn't at work, but trying to walk home hundreds of miles from a business trip gone awry. She could still use the bathroom, but couldn't flush right now, since the generator wasn't running and there'd be limited water pressure. As she walked by the bedroom window, she stopped in her tracks. She walked over to the window and stood in front of it in shock. About 2 dozen cows were grazing on her lawn.
Shit, she thought.
Then, remembering her garden, which she could not see from this window, she said it aloud.
Shit!
She'd slept in one of Jim's t-shirts, but their yard was private, and there would be no one out there to see her running around dressed as she was. The house was set back off the road and fairly private. Besides, this was an emergency. She stepped into a pair of flip-flops and went to the kitchen. From the kitchen door, she could see more cows strolling through the garden, trampling plants and helping themselves to anything that looked tasty. She was furious and nearly blind with anger. Now more than ever, they might need that food. She snatched up a broom and flew out the door. From the back porch, she could immediately see the problem. Without power, the 2 strands of electric fence that usually held the cows at bay in the pasture next door were now of little consequence to the large animals. The cows had pushed the 2 strands of wire down and walked across them to the greener pastures of Ellen's backyard and garden. She waded into the cows, trying to urge them out of her garden without doing any more damage. They chewed and paid little attention to her, used to people as they were. That was until she started swinging the broom. Like a domestic ninja, she wielded the broom with martial precision, swatting cows and driving them from her garden. They bolted and lunged, taking flight urgently now that they were under attack. Running back and forth, she herded them to the front yard and then kept them moving down the driveway. When she reached the gate at the end of the driveway, she ran ahead of the cows and opened it. This action startled some of the cows into retreating and turning back toward the house. Ellen cursed loudly, running along the fence line to get back between the cows and the house and turn them in the right direction. Swinging the broom and yelling, she was able to bring them to a stop and get them moving back toward the gate, where she drove them through it and onto the gravel road in front of the house. Typically, she and Jim would have driven them back across the fence, back into their own pasture, but that would have been pointless because they would have just come back across into her yard. She didn't like that particular neighbor very much and had no way to call him and let him know his cows were out. He would just have to find out on his own. The cows would probably stay in the road in front of her house anyway, eating tall grass from the shoulder of the road, and their owner could deal with them later. Driving the last black beast through the gate, she stopped and leaned against the gate, sweating and catching her breath. It was only then that she realized she had an audience. 2 men she did not recognize stood across the road from her, rifles resting on their shoulders. Their grins revealed that they had apparently enjoyed the show, seeing her running around driving the cattle in the t-shirt that barely covered her panties. She gripped the broom tightly, and a cold fist closed around her heart. She was not only half-dressed. She was unarmed and vulnerable.
This could be where it all ended. She immediately thought of her children. Her carelessness could mean the end for all of them. One man was bearded and wore the reflective work clothes of someone who worked in the coal mines or natural gas business. She did not know the man, nor did she recall seeing him in the vehicles that came and went from the trailer park up the road, which was where she assumed he came from. She knew nearly everyone on this road, with the exception of the more transient population that moved in and out of that trailer park. The other man was also bearded and wore hunting camouflage and a John Deere hat. Ellen did not recall him either. He had a single rabbit hanging dead from his belt.
"They're just hunting," she told herself. "Be cool and get back to the house. Act with authority, or at least as much authority as a woman with her ass hanging out can act with."
"Them your cows?" the man with the rabbit asked.
"No," she said, trying to keep her voice steady. "They came through the fence."
The man continued to look her over, leaving her feeling very uncomfortable. One averted his eyes and looked toward her house.
"Where's your husband?" he asked. "Why's he got you out here playing cowgirl?"
Ellen stared at the man, knowing full well that it had dawned on him that there must not be any man at her house, or she would not be out chasing cows dressed as she was.
"Cut it off now," she told herself. "Get back to the house. Now."
"If you'll excuse me, I have work to do," she said. She turned and walked back through the gate, feeling the man's eyes on her backside. She swung the gate shut and latched it. She would have to remember to put a padlock on it today. She turned from the gate and began walking back up to the house, the man silent, watching. She worried that the man's awareness of Jim's absence may be the beginning of a problem, though she was not sure what she could do about it. They would just have to be careful, vigilant, and stay armed at all times. Not having her gun with her could have cost her dearly. She could have been raped, robbed, or killed. Her children could have been killed. She would have to focus on not reacting so quickly. When anything happened from this point on, she would have to examine it from all angles before taking any action. She would have to make their safety the first priority. In her fear and rush of paranoia, it hit her that this would have been a perfect ruse to draw her out of the safety of her house. Someone could have let those cows out to make her come outside. She didn't feel like that was what had taken place this time, but it could be next time. She could not leave the house without making sure that things were safe, and decided never to leave the house unarmed again. She would need to return to Jim's binder. There was information in there about securing the house, and she needed to read it today. She was not able to relax enough to draw a full breath until she reached the steps of her house. Up until that point, she had listened carefully for the clank of the gate latch, or the sound of footsteps running up on her from behind. She didn't know what she would do if they came after her. She supposed she would have to run, maybe even fight for her life. Would she have screamed for the children to help her? To bring a gun? What would she do? When she climbed the steps and reached the front door, safety just feet away, she found it locked. It was then that she remembered she had come out the back door. Another painful mistake. Another reminder of how she needed to be doing a better job of this. She turned and went back down the steps. When she took a glance at the road, she found the men were still there, still watching her. When she got to the corner of the house, she lost all composure and ran to the back door as fast as she could, climbing the steps two at a time and hurtling herself through the door. Once inside, she threw the latches and locked the door. Only then did the tears come. She shook and sobbed, sliding down the door onto the floor and curling herself into a ball at the base of the door. She would have to think differently to survive. She could not fail so miserably again. Her life and the lives of her children depended on it. By the time Pete and Ariel woke up, Ellen had regained her composure. She had changed clothes and made coffee on the camp stove out back. She'd also dug a thick belt from her closet and now wore the Smith & Wesson shield on her belt and a Kydex holster. On the opposite side of her belt was a nylon pouch with a Velcro closure that held two spare mags. The faithful Ruger LCP was in her back pocket. She would not be caught unarmed again. While she drank her coffee, Ellen made breakfast on the gas camping stove. She cooked refrigerated food that needed to be eaten soon. There were eggs, bacon, and biscuits. With them, she served slightly soft butter and homemade peach preserves. The softening butter reminded her that it was time to run the generator. She was able to start it with less trouble this time. The noise of the engine was better than an alarm clock and had both children roused in no time. They found their way to the kitchen and were eating groggily when she sat with them and sipped her coffee. "You guys okay this morning?" she asked. They nodded but said nothing, nibbling sleepily at their food. "What would you think about your grandparents coming out and staying with us for a while?" "That'd be fine," Ariel said. They were silent for a while. Then Pete furrowed his brow. "Why do you want them to come out here and stay with us?" "Two reasons," Ellen said. "I'm worried about them being out there alone. I'm not sure they have as much camping and survival stuff as we do." "They don't," Ariel said. "They think Daddy is silly buying all this stuff." Ellen wondered if they still thought he was silly under present circumstances. She doubted it. "Why else?" Pete asked. Ellen carefully considered her words. "Because I think we need some extra help," she said. "I think it would be safer to have everyone together. We'd have more people to keep an eye on things." What Ellen left unsaid was that Jim's dad could handle the gun if needed, and Jim's mom could help keep Ariel entertained while the rest of them kept an eye on things. She'd already tried to send them a text this morning, having been unable to reach them with a call. They only used their cell phones sporadically, so it was hard to know if they even had them turned on or not. She would have to go out there and speak to them in person. Had it not been for the incident at the gate this morning, she would have been fine with leaving Pete home, locked in the house, and keeping an eye on things. He was at the age where he could stay home for short periods of time by himself, albeit under less concerning circumstances. Now that she was sure they had drawn some unwanted attention, she couldn't take a chance on Pete being home if something happened. She would have to load the children into her vehicle, and they would have to make a quick trip to Jim's parents' house, hoping that their home was safe when they returned. Jim's dad was in the yard walking their dog when Ellen and the kids pulled up. Their trip had been relatively uneventful. Ellen had not wanted to leave their home using the main road because she was concerned about people seeing her leaving the house vulnerable. She'd cut through a neighbor's field and used a farm road to cross his property, exiting at a gate that was closer to town and on a different road than the one they lived on. Ellen had never driven the road before but had heard about it from Jim, who often cut firewood on the neighbor's property. She made a mental note to return this way, too. The kids jumped out of the car immediately and ran to Pops. Pete to hug Pops, Ariel to hug the dog. Ellen climbed out, then reached back inside and removed the Remington 870. She hung it over her shoulder and joined the kids. "What's with the firepower?" Pops asked, smiling. "Things must be calm here," Ellen said. "I'm a little concerned about where things are going, though."
"You could always come join us here,"
Pops said, coming over and giving Ellen a squeeze. Ellen hugged him back.
"That's not why we're here. Besides checking up on you guys, I was interested in seeing if you wanted to come stay with us."
Pops scratched his chin. He handed the leash to Ariel, who wanted to lead the dog around the yard.
"I don't know," he said. "Things have been really quiet here."
"That's because you're close to the emergency services office and the state police substation. I think we're better prepared than you at our place, though."
"We have some emergency preparations," Pops said.
"What I'm hearing is that this could last a year," Ellen said, her voice low to keep Pete from hearing. He was wandering off to see his grandmother.
"Why a year?"
"Well, Jim has read a lot about this," Ellen said. "There's no manufacturing capacity to repair all the electrical components that have been damaged. There's no refinery capacity to provide enough fuel to keep commerce moving. Food will be running out. Fuel is already restricted. Without power, people will start dying off.
Pop's expression had gone from the joy of seeing them to one of grave concern.
I'll have to talk to Nana and see what she thinks.
That's fine, Ellen said, starting to walk toward the house with Pops.
You think you guys can hold out for a year? He asked.
I think so, Ellen said. We have a lot more preparations than you might think. We have some solar, we have food, we have a spring and a way to purify the water. We also have enough weapons to defend ourselves if need be.
Pops laughed. Surely you're not so paranoid as to think things will get that bad, he said.
Has Jim planted those seeds in your head?
It's not just Jim, Ellen said.
They entered the garage and started through the laundry room.
Things will disintegrate rapidly as people start to run out of food and water, she continued. One of the neighbors stopped by and said that things were already starting to get a little sketchy in the trailer park up the road from the house. When those people get desperate, they'll start to look at what they can take from their neighbors.
Pops considered this.
This morning, I had a little encounter with two men at the gate that left me feeling very uncomfortable, she added.
Pops stopped and turned to her.
Did they hurt you?
He asked.
What happened?
Ellen stared at the ground, not comfortable with admitting her own carelessness.
Cattle got loose in the yard, she said. They were in the garden. I went outside to herd them out of the yard. I ran them through the front gate and didn't notice two men were down there.
Doing what?
Hunting, she said. They had guns and a dead rabbit.
Did they say anything to you?
They asked if my husband was home, Ellen said, and they watched me all the way back to the house. It made me feel uncomfortable. I didn't have my gun.
Pops reached over and hugged her again. Ellen fought back tears, not wanting to appear weak in front of anyone.
It'll be fine when Jim gets home, she said. We just don't know when that will be.
Let me talk to Nana, he said. We'll pack up some stuff and come out until Jim gets back. I really think this whole mess will be over soon. Give me some time to convince her and to get our stuff packed.
Ellen experienced a wave of relief. Even though they were older and of a different mindset than she and Jim were about this whole experience, just having adults to share the load would be helpful.
Thanks, Pops, she said.
Ellen and Ariel were back home about 90 minutes from when they left. Although it went against every instinct Ellen had, she had left Pete with Nana and Pops. She had been afraid of them separating for any reason, but Pete had convinced Ellen that he would be needed to help them with loading Pop's truck. Pops agreed that it would indeed be helpful to have him there doing some of the legwork. Ellen kept telling herself that Pete staying with them, helping them load more quickly, would get them to the house that much sooner. Ellen had approached her house through the same back way that she had used when leaving. From a distance, she saw nothing amiss. When they slowly crept into the driveway in front of the house, they sat for a moment with the engine running, looking for movement. They saw nothing suspicious. She killed the engine and exited the vehicle.
"Wait here," she told Ariel. "I'm locking my door behind me."
Ariel, who was unaware of the early morning events, appeared to be sensitive to the tension in the air and offered no comment on Ellen's behavior. Ellen drew the shotgun into a low ready position and clicked the safety off. She circled the house carefully. She checked the locks on the outbuildings and on the house. There were no indications of any visitors. She put the shotgun back on safe and slung it over her shoulder. She returned to the car.
"We're good, little girl," she said. "Let's get in the house."
Ellen expected she'd have a couple of hours to burn before Pops made it here. She knew that she'd probably need to have a meal fixed for everyone, too. With the morning's events fresh in her head, though, she wanted to review the binder Jim had left her and see what he had in the section on securing the house. She had not had a chance to read it yet, but it was looming over her as something that she needed to focus on more. Perhaps with the extra hands arriving later, they might be able to take some of the measures that Jim's manual suggested. She retrieved the manual from the nightstand in their bedroom and took it to the front porch swing. She had the manual tucked under her arm, a glass of water in her hand, and her shotgun hung over her shoulder.
She placed the water glass on the porch rail, propped the shotgun within reach, and sat down. She thumbed through the tabs and came to the section she was looking for. "This section is a work in progress and not as detailed as I'd like it to be. If you're reading this without me, I apologize in advance." Those words stung her heart. "The idea of this section is to let you know how to secure our home in the event of a crisis. I do not have space for all the ideas, so some of them will require some creativity to put into effect. All I'm doing is listing what we have on hand and some ideas for what I planned on doing with it. 1. Wood. We have scraps of plywood of various sizes in the shop building. These can be installed over windows using a cordless drill and 3-inch screws. In theory, I would also cut gun ports into these. Nails can be driven through the wood, and those boards left with the nails point up so that intruders will step on the nails. 2. Wire fencing. Behind the shop are several rolls of old fencing of different sizes and patterns. These can be put over windows if need be, although they provide no protection against breakage. 3. Barbed wire. There are 2 old rolls of barbed wire behind the shop building that can be used to create barriers on the property. 4. Steel. There are various pieces of steel from plates to beams that could be used for different things. The steel plate could create a bullet-resistant barrier. The steel beams, placed with the excavator, could block the road and would be too heavy to move out of the way by hand. 5. Lighting. There's a 6-pack of solar motion-activated security lights in the daddy shack that I never got around to installing. Since they don't need power, they can be installed anywhere from on a tree to on a post to on the side of a building. 6. Nails. There are lots of nails in the buildings. Driven through an old scrap of plywood, they could be used to create spike strips that could prevent someone from driving a car or an ATV up to the house. 7. Party poppers. There's a gross 144 of party poppers in the building. These are the little fireworks where you pull a string and the thing pops and shoots confetti out the end. Used in conjunction with a tripwire, these can create a primitive perimeter alarm. 8. Tripwires. There are several rolls of masonry string for creating tripwires with the party poppers. There are also several big rolls of fishing line for creating tripwires, but they can't be tied easily to the party poppers. You can take the fishing line and tie a little bell to it, or a can full of rocks, or some wind chimes, anything that makes noise. 9. Battery-operated perimeter alarms. When Lowe's was closing out a line of cheap home security products, I bought a couple of driveway alarms. These are battery-operated devices that you can stick outside. They shine a beam on a reflector that bounces it back to the device. If this beam is broken by a car or person, an alarm sounds in the house. The thing runs on batteries but has a limited signal range, so test it before trusting it. 10. NVD. The most valuable piece of equipment may be the night vision device that is in the bottom of the gun safe. I keep one in my bug-out bag when I travel, but there's a spare in the gun safe. They use AA batteries. It's the same one that I've shown you how to operate before. It's not the greatest device in the world. The image is cheesy, the optics not so great, and there's no magnification. But you can clearly see if someone is walking around the house at night. They will most likely not be expecting this, so you'll have surprise on your side. And 11, there are many more things you can do. Be creative. Get Pete to apply his creativity to it also. If you have lots of time, the excavator can be used to dig strategic ditches that you could use as shooting trenches. Ellen closed the book and stared out at the vacant land surrounding her house. She'd never looked at it before as a place that might have to be defended. Seeing the vast open spaces around it, she questioned whether it could even be defended at all. She quickly brushed that aside. She could not have that attitude. It was her job to keep things safe until Jim returned. She could not think about defenses now. It was overwhelming to her. But the wheels were turning. She would get started on clearing a room for Nana and Pops, then start a meal. After dinner, she would walk the yard with Pete and Pops, and they would come up with a plan together. Chapter 14. The road across the farmer's land was deceptively easygoing for the first half mile and had us in good spirits. We were pleased at making progress and taking our fate back into our own hands. Just beyond that first half mile, the road quickly became steep, and before long, all conversation stopped as we huffed and puffed our way uphill. This was the point on the topographic map where the contour lines got closer and closer together. No matter how fit you were, climbing a steep hill with a load got the heart pumping. I frequently checked on Randy, who was red-faced and breathless, but keeping up. "Need another smoke break?" I yelled back to her, smiling. She gave me the middle finger and kept plodding along. You had to respect someone who could be a smartass while so clearly suffering. Though hiking and backpacking could be very strenuous, it felt good to be doing it. 10 years ago, I had suffered from bad allergies and had developed what my doctor called allergic asthma. My breathing sucked, and I would sometimes get short of breath while walking between buildings at work. I saw several doctors, including specialists, and nothing helped. I took 4 medications a day and only got worse. In a last-ditch effort to find something that would work, I read a promising study on acupuncture. That led to one of the greatest healthcare discoveries in my life, Dr. Wu. Dr. Wu was a diminutive Chinese lady who had a practice about an hour from my home. She was from San Francisco originally, had received a degree there in traditional Chinese medicine, and was a licensed acupuncturist. She saved my life. Within 6 weeks, I was improving. My pulmonologist, who saw me monthly, monitored me throughout those early weeks and was astounded at my progress. Within a year, I felt well enough to try to improve my deteriorated physical condition, so I bought a bike. On my inaugural ride, I coasted the bike 50 feet down my driveway and then turned to pedal back. About halfway up, I was gasping for air, my hamstrings spasming, and I collapsed in the driveway, laying on my back and wondering if I could get my money back. I kept it up, though, and my conditioning steadily improved. That was 8 years ago since that first visit with Dr. Wu, and I had few allergy symptoms at all. I could run a 5K and could road bike a full 100 miles. I wasn't setting any records, but in my late 40s I felt stronger than I ever had before. I knew that I could walk home. At the top of a ridge, the fire road crossed a well-worn path. I removed my pack and sank to the ground, a sweaty mess. I retrieved my GPS from the side pocket of my pack and checked the coordinates. It appeared that this was indeed the Appalachian Trail. I was draining a water bottle when Randy and Gary topped the ridge and joined me. Gary lowered his pack to the ground, took out a water bottle from it, and stood in place, sweat rolling down his face. Randy sat down abruptly, then flopped over backward, pack and all. She was breathing hard, but not hyperventilating. She'd live, and I knew that she'd make it home, too. She was tough. "Shit," she muttered when she was able to speak. "She's alive, Gary," I said. I wasn't sure there for a second. I dug in my open pack and took out another candy bar and began devouring it. I leaned the upright pack toward Gary and offered to take one if he wanted. "I think I'll eat one of my own," he said. "It'll lighten my own load by a tiny bit." I asked Randy if she wanted one, but she was still unable to string together enough words to make a sentence. I picked a candy bar from the mix and pitched it toward her collapsed form. "Eat it between breaths," I said. "You'll need the energy." An electronic ding startled me, and I realized that it was my cell phone. Gary and Randy's phones were not far behind, beginning to chime their own alerts, and soon we were all receiving text messages that had been unable to reach us before. "This ridge must have put us in range of a functional network," Gary said, digging for his phone. All the texts were from my wife. I started at the beginning and went through them in order. "Received your messages, but not sure if you're getting mine. Found your instruction book and have carried out all instructions. Be careful." Her next text was 2 hours later. "Bought last of supplies on list at store. Waiting in line for more fuel now. Line's getting long. Kids with me. Using caution."
That phrase about using caution was straight out of my instruction manual. I'd told them to go to the store and pick up last-minute supplies with cash if there was the opportunity, even though we were well-stocked. I also advised them to go armed, and I took that statement of hers to mean that she had heeded my warning. There was another text from 8:55 p.m. last night. Everyone home and safe, kids helping, following manual. The last text was from this morning. Worried about you, love you, and hope you are safe. We're fine here, so take care of yourself and get home soon. I was suddenly aware of their absence in a very immediate and painful way. We were a close family and did a lot together. I fought back tears, but I knew that it was as much a result of stress and fatigue as missing them. I reined it in and composed a quick text back. Have signal for a minute and got all your texts. I'm fine and starting home on the route I planned. May take weeks. Be careful. Love you and the kids very much. After sending it, I tried to call her but got a message that all circuits were busy. I looked up to see Randy and Gary doing the same thing, composing texts through tear-filled eyes. Well, ain't this just a shit sandwich? I said. Damn right, Randy said, her voice quavering. I pulled out my map while they continued reading and texting. My GPS gave me an accurate picture of where we were on the map, so I went right to it, even though the fire road we'd used was not in existence when my map was created. It appeared to be about 6 miles to the next shelter. With this being our first day, it seemed like a good place to stop for the day and spend the night. We could cook dinner, rest up, and start fresh the next morning. With this being the peak hiking season, there would likely be other hikers there, and perhaps even a full house. If that was the case, they were just going to have to make room. I had a small tarp and the garbage bags for improvising a shelter, but I wouldn't have to if there was a structure we could use. We could go about 6 more miles and stay at the next shelter, if that's fine with you guys, I said. Shelters? Randy asked. What kind of shelters? There are overnight shelters scattered along most of the trail at different intervals, so thru-hikers can spend the night in them if so inclined. They allow you to get out of the weather or avoid setting up a tent if you want to save some time. Most of them are just three-sided stalls with a roof, but some of them are two stories with a loft. Some of the most commonly used shelters even have outhouses. There will probably be other hikers there, Gary added. This is prime time for hiking the AT. We'll know when we get close, I said. You'll smell the hikers before you see them. Randy wrinkled her nose, but she wasn't complaining about not having to sleep on the ground. I decided not to tell her that most of the shelters had mice, too. Is the rest of the day going to be as steep as what we've done already? She asked, a note of worry in her voice. I got up and walked over to her, sitting beside her. I laid the map out and pointed to the contour lines between us and the next shelter. See how the lines are mostly loops and the spaces between the lines are consistent? She nodded. That means that for the most part this will be an afternoon of ridge running, with some brief rolling climbs, primarily staying at the same elevation. She looked at me blankly. What the hell does that mean? Put that in a language a grandmother can understand. Not flat, I said. But no more major climbs today, either. Thank God. When I folded the map and turned to tuck it in my pack, I heard the flick of a lighter. I turned to find her relishing a cigarette. I can't believe you're doing that, Gary said. I might as well enjoy it while I can, she said. After a few more minutes, I rose to my feet, stiff from the first climb of the morning, and stretched my muscles. It wasn't a bad stiffness, though. It felt good to be using my muscles and following a trail. I guess that means you're ready to walk? Randy asked. I continued stretching the sore spots. We have 6 more miles to cover. We can probably do about 2 miles an hour, all things considered. That would put us at the next shelter by early afternoon. There'll still be hours of daylight left, Gary said. Are you sure we shouldn't just push until the daylight runs out? It's up to you guys, I said. I'm fine with pushing. I just thought we might benefit from a shorter day and a good night's rest in a shelter. If we push on, there's no guarantee we'll make it to another shelter when we stop,
We may have to sleep on the ground in the woods.
But we could be miles closer to home if we walk closer to dark, Randy said, dropping her cigarette and grinding the butt beneath her shoe.
I hated seeing her litter, but didn't feel like I could ask her to carry a pocket full of cigarette butts under the current circumstances. It was a different world now. I had to remember that.
We could, I conceded. If y'all want to try it, I'm fine with it.
Let's do it, Gary said. Those texts I got have given me a second wind. I bent over and picked up my pack, closing any open pockets and zippers. With everything tucked back in its proper place, I swung the pack onto my shoulders and buckled the waist belt. Randy and Gary weren't far behind, showing a new determination and less doubt about following this trail home. Once we hit the trail, we made good time. Everyone was walking strong and keeping a steady pace. We stayed on our feet for a few standing breaks while we sucked down water and ate candy bars. I was already beginning to tire of the candy bars and was anxious for a change of menu. We passed no other hikers and saw no one until we approached the Bear Den shelter a little after 4 p.m. "Shelter dead ahead," I announced. Chapter 15. Ellen was relieved to discover that the truck she heard approaching the house belonged to Pops. She'd been expecting him through the front gate, but Pete had obviously guided him onto the same farm road that they had used this morning. The truck was creeping as if it was loaded down, and Pops was pulling his enclosed dual-axle trailer behind him. Ellen thought for a moment about having him park the rig around back, but decided it was probably better to have it parked around front, making it look like more people were here. Maybe that would make them less of a tempting target for any rogues living in the trailer park. Pops pulled up beside her vehicle and killed the engine. The doors opened, and Pops, Pete, Nana, and their dog all came spilling out. Ariel went running down the porch steps and hugged her Nana, then took the dog's leash and began showing him around the yard.
"Thanks for coming," Ellen said, as Nana came and hugged her.
"It's okay," Nana told her. "We really couldn't do much at our house anyway. We have the generator, but we didn't want to burn up all our gas in case we needed it for the vehicles."
"We've got a few tricks up our sleeves out here," Ellen replied. "Jim has prepared for something like this."
Nana looked around and shook her head.
"I always thought he was a little paranoid, but I'm not so sure now. He always said that a few hiccups in the wrong place at the wrong time could bring the whole house down."
"His paranoia came from being better informed than most of us," Ellen said. "He was aware of the risks and vulnerabilities."
"I'm kind of glad I didn't know all that," Nana said. "I'm not sure I would have been able to sleep at night."
What Ellen didn't say was that feeling as if her family was prepared for those hiccups in the system had helped her sleep better at night.
"Come help us unload some of this stuff," Pops called.
Ellen and the kids helped Pops and Nana unload for the next hour. They brought suitcases with their clothes and toiletries. Not knowing what the weather would bring or how long they would be staying, they also brought a wide variety of outerwear and shoes. They'd filled two coolers with remaining food from their refrigerator and freezer, as well as boxes with canned foods and other staples. Ellen and Pete carried those to the kitchen to deal with later. Pops had brought a few cans of Coleman fuel, two cases of 1-pound propane cylinders for the camp stove and lanterns, and over a dozen 5-gallon fuel cans of gas and diesel fuel. He'd even brought all the toilet paper they had in the house. He'd cleaned out his gun safe, and the contents were piled in the trailer. There were milk crates full of ammunition. Ellen had not realized that Pops was such an ammo hoarder. She'd never heard it discussed, but she was certain that she was looking at probably 10,000 rounds of assorted calibers. There was an old college footlocker in the trailer, and Pops raised the lid to show her that it was full of pistols and magazines. There were nearly 2 dozen rifles, some in gun cases, some wrapped in blankets, stacked in the trailer. It was the lifetime firearm collection of a man who enjoyed occasional hunting and frequent target shooting.
"Let's stash those in the basement," Ellen said.
"Fine with me," Pops said.
"I think you need to start wearing a gun all the time," Ellen said. I'd also pick a rifle and shotgun to keep handy, something you've got plenty of ammo for.
Pops dug into the trunk and pulled out a Ruger SR-9 and a holster and clipped it onto his belt. A little more digging produced three spare mags.